is a beautiful Easter sunrise. I just wish I was somewhere else. I'm sure you do too. Today is going to be a very important day to us in our struggle to control this situation. The Exxon response team on site has grown to over 50 members. These are Exxon personnel. Plus we have about 40 experts and contract managers. So the total force managing, advising, and supervising the response activities is now approaching 100 people. In addition, we have about 200 people contracted for work crews. These involve union as well as non-union personnel, local help, as well as those specially trained personnel that we've flown in from other parts of Alaska. We're also mobilizing local fishermen to help with the waterborne activities. We will increase this workforce as our cleanup activities expand. Am I coming across okay? Good. As of 8 a.m. this morning, the major slick covered approximately 12 square miles. There's been very little movement or spread in the past 15 hours. No new leakage is apparent from the vessel. The slick is centered southwest of Bligh Island and northwest of Naked Island. We are booming along the most sensitive areas of the eastern shore. That began this morning, and that will be ongoing throughout the day, and I'm sure throughout the next few days. Cleanup activities along Bligh Island are being initiated. We have 5 skimmers in operation. 6 more skimmers are currently being placed in operation. We have 2 large barges and 1 80,000-ton tanker, which are available to collect the oil from the skimming operations. The second part of the dispersion test is planned for this morning. It should be underway right now, and we hope to have a full assessment of the effectiveness by midday. The burn test was conducted last night, and it was, from what I understand, successful, and this could be a useful technique to burn isolated patches of the spill. The technique, just very generally as I understand it, is to boom off parts of the spill, allow it to collect, and then ignite it with a laser gun. The cargo transfer from Exxon Valdez to Exxon Baton Rouge started at about 10 p.m. last night using 2 portable pumps. They had transferred 28,000 barrels by 8 a.m. this morning. We have 5 more pumps which will be in place today. We are also flying in a special manifold from Portland. It will be used to collect the discharge from these 7 pumps and to move it across to the 1 discharge hose which is connected to the Exxon Baton Rouge. We hope to get the transfer rate up over 12,000 barrels an hour. That would be about 300,000 barrels a day. That should take us about 3 days from the time we do get the operation up to maximum rate. We also have initiated an environmental assessment program, and that's being implemented in coordination with state and federal resource agencies and also with the local fishermen's groups. We have met with the representatives of all these groups, and we've established the following program. Our first priority is to identify sensitive areas, to prioritize these areas, and begin placement of exclusion booms. That's underway right now. Our second priority is to assess the biological and ecological impacts of the spill on the following: water quality, sediment, photoplankton, zooplankton, and fish populations, including herring, salmon, bottom fish, and shellfish. The program is being coordinated with the following resource agencies. And I'm going to give you a lot of initials, and I will have to find out later what they all mean. ADEC, ADF&G, DOI, I guess that's the Department of Interior, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, NOAA, and NMFS. I apologize for not knowing the names of all those initials, but we'll get it to you. The consultants involved include Lisa Haas with American North, Davis and Moore, Jim Hemming, Mr. Randall Davis from the Hubs Marine Research Center, and Alice Berkner with International Bird Reserve Center. And all those activities are about to begin. I'd like to do two other things based on the information that we collected. First is to go over the sequence of events as we understand it from the time the pilot was dropped off until the vessel grounded. And the second is to go over how the damage occurred to the vessel and the vessel's condition as it sits right now. And we'll be using the five charts to my left. Mr. Ed McDonald from Exxon is going to assist me. As soon as Ed speaks, you'll recognize him as a native Texan. Starting with the first chart, what we're showing on this chart is the traffic lane coming out of Valdez, and we've marked the vessel aspect and position at different times during this event. We've also shown the ice coming out of the Columbia Glacier across the traffic lane. Ed, if I could start with the point where the vessel dropped off the pilot. That's the second marking. That's where the vessel was when it dropped off the pilot. The vessel then proceeded along the outbound lane. It requested permission to move from the outbound lane across to the easternmost edge of the traffic lane in order to avoid the ice flows that were coming across the lane off of the Columbia Glacier. The vessel at that point was heading at a due south course of 180, and the plan was to move to the eastern edge of the traffic lane and then return to a course of 220 heading down the eastern edge of the traffic lane. The vessel proceeded to maneuver around the ice flow at some point where Ed's pointer is, that vessel position just above that, Ed. At about that point, we believe that the mate realized that he needed to get back into the traffic lane, and he then began a sharp turn to the west. The vessel was, a vessel tends to slide around the turn, and the southern motion of the vessel continued as the vessel's heading moved from due south to due west. And the vessel came to rest at a point, if you take the center of the vessel itself, it's about 1.1 miles to the east of the traffic lane, in a heading of 280, which is just about due west. And that's where she's resting on the reef.
One more time again, from the point where he made the corrective action.
At about this point, the vessel, the mate began to make his turn. We suspect he realized he was beyond the lane at that point, and gave a hard turn to starboard. The vessel at that point continued its motion in a southerly course while its heading was moving from due south to due west. Just prior to the impact point, the vessel was heading on a course of 280, and we know that by looking at the slide marks on the ship, and we'll talk on the ship's bottom. We'll talk a little bit more about that.
Grounding, rather than a port grounding?
I think you'll see, if you let me get on to the other charts, well, one of the mysteries has been why is the vessel aground the way it is, but the starboard side is damaged. And we'll go through that in a minute, if that's what your question is.
After of ice that we see there, is that actual ice or speculated ice?
It's speculated. What we know is that it was blocking the outbound lane and the separation median in between the two lanes, and that condition is about the same as it was about 3 hours previous, because another vessel coming out of Valdez 3 hours or so ahead of us had to request the same permission, but at that point they were able to maneuver down the inboard lane. That's the eastern edge of the traffic lane.
And what kind of danger does that kind of ice pose to a ship of this size?
Depending upon the size of the bergs, and of course this was at midnight, probably should tell you that, but the pilot drop-off was at 0038 or 1238 a.m. And the grounding time was approximately 1 hour later. Is the time on air, Ed? 0104. Sorry, yeah, 0104, and then the actual grounding.
The grounding was 1:04 a.m.?
I don't have the times with me right now, unfortunately.
This job.
Yeah, what is it? 0104 was a different point. I had it in my notes from yesterday, but I don't have it with me right now. But it was approximately 1 hour after the pilot was disembarked, and that disembark time, as I recall, was 0038.
And the danger of the ice, did you say that posed to this, to a ship of this kind?
We have to recall this, at this point the ice was apparent through radar, was the middle of the night. Clearly, depending upon the size of those ice flows, it does create a danger to the vessel as far as damage to the vessel's bow. No, there's no record kept of radar images. We're not able to do that. I don't think anybody else can either.
Inbound lane?
I don't know that either. Judging from how he was trying to work his way to the far edge of the sea lane, I imagine it was. But I'm just speculating.
We've been told that if a tanker is moving at a relatively slow speed, the ice is not a danger to the tanker. Is that incorrect?
I believe the tanker was moving at a very slow speed, because from the time she dropped the pilot off until it grounded was about 1 hour, and that's a distance of 8 miles measured in a due south direction. So during that period, the vessel made good over ground about 8 miles. Now we suspect her speed over ground was about this 8 miles an hour.
No, I guess what I'm asking is what SOP is when a tanker is confronted by ice in this area. Is the tanker supposed to make sure it does not get anywhere near it, or is it supposed to go to a speed where it can go through it or touch it without damage to the ship? What is SOP?
I believe what they do is pretty standard, is to move to the eastern edge of the traffic lane and to proceed at whatever speed the captain believes is the right speed for the conditions. I would believe that would be slower than full, and I think that's what they were doing here. But beyond that, I'm not an expert.
Is it a normal course of activity, Mr. Majorasi, to allow pilots off a boat only if the person who's piloting from that point on
has a special certificate?
Yes.
Did the man who was in charge of the ship when the captain was in his cabin, did he have such a certificate?
No. Okay, if I could then move to the events as we think they occurred. We believe there are actually two damage impacts. The first one occurred, and let me just explain to you what what we're showing in the next chart is a cross-section of the vessel as if you were aft looking forward. So you're looking at the vessel cut in half, a cutaway section. You're on the stern looking out toward the bow. The port side or left side of the vessel is on your left, and the starboard side or the right side is as you see it there. The dimensions of the vessel, the full depth is 88 feet. And the width, although we're not exactly the scale, is 166 feet, its beam. We believe after viewing the divers, after seeing the divers report and talking to the people on the vessel who have the divers video, we believe that a contact was first made with a rock pinnacle at about 50 feet below the surface, and it struck at the very bottom right corner of the vessel, and it hit what we call a bilge keel. Right at that point, there are two protrusions coming out from the hull, and these protrusions are there to dampen the rolling action of the vessel. And we believe the first contact was with that bilge keel. And we'll talk a little later when we get to the far end and talk about the damage assessment. You'll see how we come to that conclusion. Shortly thereafter, there was a second contact, and that contact was with a rock pinnacle, and it was basically right down the center line of the vessel. We could talk a little bit about more of those, but let me just continue to proceed. As the vessel stands right now, or rests right now, she's resting on a pinnacle. These are not exact descriptions of the pinnacle. We're working from a diver's assessment of what he saw. So it looks like you can figure out from the middle picture and the one just to the right, the two aspects of the vessel as it rests on the rock pinnacle. Moving to the last chart. Now this is a chart looking down at the top of the vessel, but the cross section is sort of cut right across the middle of the vessel. So you're looking top down. The bow is where Ed is pointing, the stern. And the starboard side is the low side, the port side is the high side. What we've shown in red is where we believe the vessel is whole. But let me go through that sequence again. We believe the first contact was along the starboard side, starting up forward at the very forward cargo tank on the starboard side. The plating there is bent and rippled. It then where you see those three peaks a little further along the side, Ed, just if you can work down the starboard side, right there, that's where the bilge keel was torn off and has created three damaged areas into those tanks. So that was all the first event, and we think that was a distinct event. And at that point, we believe the vessel was on a heading of 180. That's as we reconstruct it, so that or approximately 180. So that occurred at about the first of those five bottom lines, we believe. Somewhere in about that position. The vessel then proceeded to change its heading due west while it was sliding roughly due south. And at that point, the vessel struck the second pinnacle right about on the center line all the way forward. Ed, you can show them the four peak damage on the other chart. Those are the first holes. And at that point, we believe the vessel, looking at the slide pattern on the paint and the sequence of holes, the vessel was heading just about due west on a 270 position, attempting to make its way back to the separation lane. There was a series of about 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 holes in the vessel. And those range in size from approximately 8 feet by 15 feet to 20 feet by 6 feet. That's about the size of those ruptures in the ship's hull. The cross-hatched area is where the vessel is now resting on the reef, and we suspect that that entire area is also damaged. There was one impact point beyond the resting point. Unfortunately, that was a bullseye because it hit right at the juncture of the transverse and longitudinal bulkheads, and it impacted 4 tanks. And we believe that was immediately after the vessel came to rest, and probably because it may have had some motion down by the stern because of the grounding action. There also are some cracks emanating from that particular spot. So as we are right now, all of the tanks along the port side are intact. 4 of those are cargo tanks, and 2 of them are ballast tanks. Number 2 and 4 are ballast tanks, so they are empty of ballast water. Number 1, 3, 5 in the the tank immediately after 5 are full of cargo, or essentially full of cargo, and are intact. The other 10, 11 tanks are breached. Hey, do we know if the starboard slop tank is breached?
We don't have any information on that at the moment.
Okay, so it may be 10 of those 11. The aftermost one on the starboard side may be intact. Those tanks now contain an oily water mixture. 2 of them are ballast tanks. There's no cargo in them, but both of those have been flooded with seawater.
Are you speculating the first strike, or do you firmly believe there was a first strike?
Well, there had to be 2 strikes, because there's no way that damage sequence could have happened simultaneously. And the strike along the starboard side at what we call the turn of the bilge had to come first.
Basically, it appears to indicate, if that's accurate, that the first strike was significantly far from where it came to rest. Is that an accurate depiction or not?
It's hard for us to say. We believe, looking at the pattern along the hull, that the vessel was basically on a heading of 180 in the first impact, that the vessel then proceeded to turn due west while it was also sliding along its original course line, and it came to rest in the position of 280. The distance between those 2 views, the last one at about a 180 heading, and the where it came to rest, my guess is about 2 miles. There is a 1 mile indicator. Ed, maybe you can show that to him, right under the title. No, up under the title. That is a 1 mile measurement that we put up there for you to be able to gauge distances. So I would guess that they're about 2 miles.
Feeling the ship strike, or is there an entry in the logbook, or did they radio a first strike?
There is an entry in the logbook.
Of a first strike?
And how
much time between that?
I don't have those times.
And did they radio that strike to the Coast Guard?
I'd have to check with VTS.
You don't know that at this point?
I don't know that.
Could you explain a little bit more about this certificate that whoever is piloting the vessel must have? Who issues it? What is it supposed to certify? And why wasn't the person piloting the vessel at this time have one?
It is a piloted certificate for Prince William Sound that certifies the vessel officer as qualified to pilot the vessel down the traffic lanes. The master does have that piloted certificate. The officer on watch does not.
Certificate.
I believe it's a Coast Guard certificate, but I'm not sure.
And the Coast Guard gives this person some kind of test, training and test, before it's issued?
Yes, it has to do with, I believe, a number of days of experience transiting, and then some sort of a qualification test, but I don't know what it is.
The third mate, who was in charge of the vessel at the time?
Yes.
Do we have his name?
I believe his name is Cousins. Yes. I don't know. Ed, do you know?
Greg. Greg, G-R-E-G-C-O-U-S-I-N-S.
To the best of my knowledge.
Is it a breach of company policy to allow someone without a certification
to be in charge of that ship?
Yes.
Is it also a breach of Coast Guard regulations?
Yes.
Had the captain retired for the night? Had he gone to bed?
I don't know that. He was in his cabin just below the bridge. I don't have the time sequence, but... he was on the bridge when the pilot was dropped off. And exactly when...
Wouldn't it be normal for the captain of the ship to take...
Okay, let me just explain what we have done to reconstruct this. We are using the vessel's course recorder. We are using the vessel's speed log. We are not using any testimony from the master or the third mate. Both of those individuals are subjects to the investigation, so anything we do say to them at this point is privileged for their defense. We are also using testimony from other individuals on the ship who are not parties to the investigation.
So, is he also part of the investigation?
Yes.
And so you're not using his testimony as well?
No.
And
I really cannot, I don't know what discussions we've had. I have reviewed the discussions we had with the other officers and personnel on board other than those three, but we really haven't begun to collect statements from those three people, and when we do, we will keep it in confidence.
And when the helm is...
It will all come out starting tomorrow with the NTSB and Coast Guard investigation. But I really don't think it's appropriate for me to disclose whatever we...
certificated?
Yes, he was an able-bodied seaman.
Were there other mates aboard who didn't have pilot certificate?
There's a chief mate and a second mate besides the master and a third mate, and I do not know if the other two had certificates. It's not unusual to have just a master certificate.
Was there a shift change at this time on the boat at all, or?
There was a, no. No, because I think we were about, the watch change probably took place well before the pilot was dropped off. The watch change normally occurs before midnight.
Based on your
news? I'm not sure with the vessel departing Valdez at roughly 9:30 whether they had in fact shifted.
Correct. Could you give us Mr. Cousins'
age and his length of service with Exxon?
I don't know his age. I believe he has 3 years service with us as a mate.
You know his hometown?
No.
Who are the three people? Is it the captain, the third mate that you are investigating, or you haven't talked about?
Well, the federal authorities have identified three people. Three individuals that they, I think the term is, are parties of interest to the investigation. And I think what that means is they need a defense. So those three people are Captain Joseph Hazelwood. Captain Hazelwood is a 20-year veteran with Exxon, 12 years as master, 20 months as master of the Exxon Valdez.
Is that
H-A-Z-L-E
or E-L?
I don't
know.
And the third individual is an able-bodied seaman, and I don't have his name. That's the helmsman.
Is your understanding that only the third mate and the helmsman were on the bridge at the time of the accident?
Certainly at the time of the initial contact. The master did return to the bridge, but I don't know exactly at what period.
So he may not have been on the, he may not have returned even after the first contact until the second contact?
I'm sure the first contact, if it was felt on that ship, he was on the bridge within seconds.
Are you you believe that, but you don't know that?
I believe that, but I do not know.
You know why he's off the bridge?
No.
Given that there was a breach of company policy here and Coast Guard policy, is there any individual or personal liability on behalf of the captain and the man who was steering the vessel at the time?
I think the liability of the master will be determined by the NTSB and Coast Guard studies. Liability of the helmsman depends upon whether he followed the orders that were issued by either the master or the mate, whoever was in control at the time. Their personal liability is to the master is primarily his license. And that's what is at risk in this study.
What condition is the ship in now? I mean, at this point, with your new information, what's the structural stability?
Well, we've tried to describe in that particular view everything we know at this point as far as the damage. Now, what the diver's survey shows is where we have holes in the plating, the outside hull plating. We do not know the condition of the internal structure which supports the hull plating. I'm sure that a lot of that is in a not in an as-built condition. We certainly believe we'll be able to do that. We are assembling a team of about 12 salvage experts. About two-thirds of those people are already in, and the rest will be coming in this afternoon. Their major tool is that diver's video. So that's very important to us. And they'll begin to look at alternatives for floating the vessel. Right now, what we're doing is getting the oil off by using portable pumps, sucking from the top of the layer, which is solid oil. And at the same time, of course, when we draw from the top, because of the hydrostatic pressure, seawater will come in from the bottom for the damaged tanks. On the port side, where we'll be drawing from intact tanks, we'll be filling those two ballast tanks, number two and number four, with ballast water as we draw from the four cargo tanks. Our objective will be to do it slowly enough that we can maintain an equilibrium and not change the vessel's weight distribution at all.
You thought before you sent the divers out?
I think we suspected just about what we have. The openings are maybe a little larger than what we thought, but you know, we were prepared for that kind of truck through the hole type situation. It's not untypical of what you see as a pattern for groundings. And it doesn't change our view of the job ahead of us at all.
I see eight distinct holes in the outer plating there and maybe a rip along the starboard side. Is that a correct count?
Yes.
I'm not counting the place where it's resting, where there may
That's
be
right.
a hole, but you don't know.
Oh, we know there's a hole.
There's
That's
a hole.
Probably
okay.
the biggest one there.
All right.
There was no apparent leakage this morning when we did the overfly.
It's still not clear why it's on the starboard side.
Why the damage is on the starboard side?
Yes.
Because of this first contact, which ripped open the very bottom corner of the vessel and opened all of those starboard tanks. Ed'll show you here on the plan view, the whole starboard lower corner of the vessel was either indented or holed as the vessel moved along that first pinnacle.
Looking at
does that help? I like to make this as clear as I possibly can for you.
Outbound should have been on the port side unless you are way far over.
No. The port side is totally intact. There is no water in those tanks.
You are considerably farther over towards Bligh Island and the reef area and much further out of the tanker lanes than would be if you had just been grazing it on the port side. And you have the reef between yourself and the tanker lanes.
Yeah, there were two impacts. I don't know how to really get to this without leaving the podium. But the vessel was heading, if I could be very demonstrative here, the vessel is heading due south. This is the starboard side and this is the port side, and I'm heading due south. We believe that she brushed a pinnacle down by my ankle, my starboard ankle. She hit a pinnacle. That's the second view.
Door.
And I'm now to the east of the tanker lane,
right.
And this young lady is the tanker lane.
Right.
And at that point, it looks like it was about a quarter of a mile outside the tanker lane.
It must have been more than a quarter of a mile according to the charts.
No, the first contact is way up here, just outside of the lane. Don't forget, the lane is going this way, and the vessel was going that way. So at the final resting point, that's the maximum point that the vessel was outside of the lane, that point is 1.1 miles. So the contacts, this triangle, at the point of the triangle...
So the vessel went...
Maybe I can move over there and help you a little bit.
How far did the vessel go between the first point of contact and the second point of contact?
She slid about 2 miles.
2 miles. But so it, going at 8 knots, it must have been going much faster than 8 knots, because if you're sliding 2 miles on rock, you would have been slowed down.
Well,
and
you dropped off
a tanker pilot,
you really
were not going 8 knots,
that.
So he must have been going much faster at the initial point of contact.
You really need to judge that by looking at a time plot. We don't have that, but we'll do it for you.
Could you do a time plot on it? Yeah.
Sure.
Also, I think the point here is that if the ship hit on the starboard side, and that means she's between the reef and Reef Island, or Bligh Island, whichever, that means she must have been further inside in order to have made that correction to go back towards the lane. So she must have been much further inside the lanes in order to hit on the starboard side.
Yeah, I can't speculate whether exactly what the plot is. There are, I think, three actual plots from the vessel. The first one is the furthest, that's even up higher, Ed, the one before that. That's one plot from the vessel's chart. If I lose those, I'll be out of business. The third one down is from the vessel's chart. The next one is from the chart, and of course the resting point. So there are four plots, as I understand it, that come from the vessel's chart.
What are your plans for the vessel once you get her offloaded and floated?
We will need to make some emergency repairs so we can move it.
Any emergency repairs?
I don't know, but it'd have to be right here. She is not in a seaworthy condition as she's holed right now, so we will have to be able to make emergency repairs in order to move her. I don't know that. But it'll be underwater repair, so it just has to be a safe haven. We'll have to find one. We'll be working with the Coast Guard.
Guess on the damage, and at what point does it become a write-off? And the last point is, given the breach of company rules and the Coast Guard regulations, is insurance valid?
last one first, we're self-insured. First one is estimate of damage. I'd rather not even estimate right now. We're obviously talking more than 10 probably less than $20 million, something like that.
How far would it have to be in order to be a write-off in your estimation?
That vessel was built 2 years ago at a cost of $125 million. She'll get a new bottom.
The Exxon vessel has been requesting a course change there to avoid ice.
I don't know, but I understand from the Coast Guard that it happens fairly frequently this time of the year.
Is it coincidental that that would shorten their trip across that lake?
The trip to San Francisco is thousands of miles. It's an eight-day trip. I can't believe you can save more than 2 minutes.
2 miles, as you say. Are you saying that there was 15 to 20 minutes possible between first and second contact?
I really don't even want to speculate until we get a time plot put together.
When do you expect that to happen?
If we have the data, we could probably do it this afternoon and get somebody to do it.
Is it your understanding that the vessel was still under... Go ahead, I'll let...
The first rock was only a quarter mile outside of the shipping lane?
I don't know that. We're trying to reconstruct in our minds, working with the plots on the vessel's chart, working with the course recorder and the speed lock. But I would believe that, well, that first contact would have to be somewhere between where the vessel was just abeam the buoy and, of course, its resting place. Exactly where that contact occurred, we don't know. But in reconstructing, that had to be a separate event. You know, it could have been, for all I know, a minute between the two of them.
And why?
To reconstruct the damage as it occurred, using the diver's video, viewing the scrape marks, you can tell just about the heading of the vessel and the aspect as those two incidents occurred, but exactly how close they were together, I don't know.
And why wasn't the mate aware of the rock? That would have shown up on your sounding equipment, on sonar equipment aboard the...
I don't really know that.
Is there some kind of alarm that's supposed to go off when you get out of the shipping lane to warn a pilot that he's had some sort of human error?
No, the shipping lane, of course, is an imaginary line. It exists only on the chart. And you know, there's no facility to cause an alarm. He should obviously have been navigating in such a way that he knew exactly where he was.
Sonar, what kind of range does, in other words, would there be anything that would let the pilot know that there's a reef out there, something he could look at,
a
radar?
Yes, the vessel is equipped with forward-looking Doppler sonar.
And how far forward does that sonar look?
I don't know the range, but certainly well within the magnitude of this situation. Pardon?
Had Cousins ever piloted a ship through Valdez before?
Yes.
He had done it before, illegally?
I don't know that.
He's uncertified, and this wasn't the first time.
Let me just come back. He has been a mate on board vessels operating out of Valdez.
Right.
Exactly where he took over, at what days, I don't know.
But we don't know, you don't know whether he had ever actually piloted a vessel through Valdez before.
I don't know that.
Is it possible that the ship would have been still under control of the bridge after the first contact? Would the first contact have made the ship unable to respond to controls on the bridge?
No. The vessel never lost steerageway, never lost power, never lost a system.
You said that you anticipated if the captain felt the first impact, he'd be up in seconds. Can you tell us how far the captain's cabin is from the bridge?
It's one flight of stairs.
That's it, one flight of stairs.
He's out his door, up a flight of stairs, and he's on the bridge.
Are you suggesting in your scenario of these two rocks that there is an uncharted rock out there that's not on the charts?
Not at all. We haven't identified exactly where the pinnacles are. Or where the first one is.
Why is it hard to figure out the time if there is a log entry, as you say?
I just don't have
Okay, so it is available, it's just not...
Yeah, we were scrambling hard this morning to create what we had
here. Fine, it's very professional.
I agree there is something missing, not intentionally.
Okay, when how much...
My orders were not to be late for this restaurant.
Great, no shaving this morning. as far as how much of this data is mechanically recorded on various, or electronically recorded by the ship, and how much of this is hand marked on logs and on charts?
The course recorder is mechanically recorded. The speed log is mechanically or electronically recorded. So you have the speed log, or it's actually the bell log, which shows what order was given to the ship at a given time. And it shows the time, it shows the order. And then you have the course recorder, which defines the vessel's heading at different times.
You said steadfastly here in these meetings that
I'm sorry, it doesn't record the vessel's heading. It records the motion, the direction of the motion of the vessel.
You know, heading this way,
the vessel could be heading in one direction, but still having its motion in another direction, and that's actually the way a vessel turns. It turns about at its center point, and as it turns, it slides into a turn to change direction.
You steadfastly maintain here that you've been satisfied with Alyeska's response time and your own, although I've heard that privately you've said otherwise. Do you want to amend what you've said here publicly
in
terms of response time?
As far as I know of Alyeska's response, they sure mobilized in a hurry.
And have you said that privately as well?
Those are my feelings. They mobilized in a hurry.
But you haven't said that. That's what you said to your friends and your associates as well?
That's what I've said, that they mobilized in a hurry. They got me out of bed in a very short period of time. And I know that they had both of their operation centers operational very shortly after I was up and awake.
But operations is different than, operation centers are different than actual...
On scene.
Yeah.
And I...